So, are we there yet? Thanks for, it's so good to be in church today. Thanks for coming out in the cold. I'm a bit jealous of Annalisa's scarf. That is a serious scarf. It's enormous. But it's a new journey. It's a new series. And it's a series about journey. Or is it? Journey is definitely the context of it. But as we look at the remarkable lives of Joseph and Moses, maybe it is more about how we deal with what a journey implies, and that is the need for patience. It's not a sprint, it's a marathon, as they say. We get frustrated at the delay of destination or even result. And I did not plan this, but we are in this space at the moment. Alicia and I are waiting on a phone call back from a builder in relation to a block in Morley. We thought we were going to hear about it on Friday, and then the weekend happened. So it's just like, there's a major life decision and we're having to deal with a delay in this phone call. You ever been waiting for a phone call and every time a phone rings, it's like, oh, oh, it can be frustrating. We get frustrated at the delay of the destination or results. Sometimes the unsatisfactory nature of going places is so acute that some social commentators question if there is any point leaving at all, just like this next one. And if you're watching online, our apologies, we can't give you the audio because of copyright, but you'll see why in a second. Enjoy this for a moment. I really like Jerry Seinfeld. You know, that, as I was watching that comedy routine, I thought to myself, it reminds me, before I was a Christian, it's like I realized that, you know, in pubs, bouncers, they put bouncers there to keep people out. But like in churches, you know, it's like they put bouncers to keep people in because you're just like running for the door straight after the service, or I was anyway, trying to get into the car. Why go out at all? Why leave if we're going to be back here anyway? That's what Homer Simpson said. What's the point of going out if we're going to end up back here anyway? Why does God use journeys, or at least allow inconvenience and waiting into individual lives and even communities? Is it just to test our patience? I say communities because we are embarking on quite a long journey as a church. We're going to start to look at some long-term plans and rhythms which will determine how we work as a church into the future. You're going to start and see some things appearing on the board behind the sound desk as you walk in over the coming Sundays. But this has been and is still a slow and detailed process. And there have been times where it's like, is it worth all this effort? Is it worth going to the effort of going on a journey of revisioning and planning for a new context? Is it worth the effort to go on that journey? And so as we're going on that sort of journey as a church, that's why I wanted us to look at the lives of Joseph and Moses. So obviously we're going to start with Joseph's story, and we start by asking who and why. But I want to share a story of another lady that challenged me. In her phenomenal memoir, Sue Monkid describes in detail a crisis point in her spiritual journey. She was a wife and a working mum, and she found that she was right in the thick of the chaos of mid-life. She'd reached that point where her kids had become just old enough to gain some measure of independence, and so she all of a sudden found she had some time to work on herself. And she reached to pick up some of those aspects of her life that she had deferred further down the road during the chaos years of raising young toddlers. Her hobbies, her work, her passions. And as she did this, she found herself confronted by so much of that which she had just put off for another day. She found that over time, she had built up residual resentments towards her husband, kids, and even God, as she struggled to reclaim a sense of her own identity. And so in the midst of all of this, she traveled to St. Menrad Arch Abbey, which is a Benedictine monastery, in an attempt to slow down, get some space, and sort some of all of this stuff out. Have you ever done that? Have you ever gone on a spiritual retreat? This is what she did. But she soon found that even living there with the monks in the slow, contemplative pace was still not working. She found herself constantly being interrupted by her inner chaos that she carried within her. She would pray with the monks in the chapel. She would walk out feeling calm and peaceful. But then she would be immediately confronted by this inner need to keep on moving, to keep on getting into something action-based, to keep on solving some unknown problem. And one day she noticed a monk sitting underneath a tree on a quiet midwinter morning, the perfect picture of peace. And she approached him and said, "You're so still and quiet. How can you just wait on God and wait on your own healing? How can you wait so patiently in the moment? I just can't get used to the idea of doing nothing," she said. The monk broke into a wonderful grin. "Well, there's the problem right there, young lady." I like that. She's in her 50s. "There's the problem there, young lady. You bought into the cultural myth that when you're waiting, you're doing nothing." She says, "He looked straight into my eyes and said, 'I hope you'll hear what I'm about to tell you all the way down to your toes. When you're waiting, you're not doing nothing. In fact, you are doing the most important something there is. You're allowing your soul space to grow up. If you can't wait, you can't become who God created you to be." Joseph was a person who did a lot, who saved the ancient world from starvation, but he was forced to wait on his journey. We burst into Genesis 37 from chapter 1. Jacob, but I thought you said it was about Joseph. We'll get to that. Jacob lived in a land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. This is the account of Jacob's family line. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And he brought their father a bad report about them. So Jacob, or if you prefer, Israel, lived in the land of Canaan. Now, just kind of fast forward, if you zoom out and just fast forward through the Old Testament for a minute, you'll know that at the end of the book of Exodus, or at the end of the Exodus, I should say, at the end of Israel's journey through the desert, as Moses goes up the mountain to die and he hands over to Joshua, the whole idea is that the people of Israel are returning to the promised land, and the promised land is Canaan. They're going back to the same place. They started there in the first place at this story here. And now eventually it's all to go back to there. What's the point? What's the point? The family of Israel at this point, however small, is already dwelling in Canaan. Why doesn't God just leave them there to just grow into a nation over the next 400 years? What's the point if they're going to be there anyway? I mean, okay, some Bible nerds will say, yeah, but you know, you're forgetting a famine is going to happen. Okay, fine. But again, fast forward. God fed Israel as a nation, let alone a small family, in the desert for 40 years. There's other ways that God can just allow them to stay there. If he's going to feed them for 40 years as they're wandering around later on in the book of Exodus, he can sustain Israel without sending Joseph to Egypt if he really needs to. But I want to say this morning, it's not just the story of Joseph or just Moses, but it's the story of God's people. God's people are deliberately moved by God away and ultimately back to the same spot over a vast amount of time. And he allows a circumstance of a prolonged slow journey into the realities of real people. And I wonder if it's so that we are not the only ones who have ever had cause to say, are we there yet? It's good to look back in Scripture and go, actually, other people have been frustrated by the slowness of the journey. Other people have had to put up with twists and turns, and we're about to see just how abrupt some of those twists and turns can be. Because Joseph is a dreamer. The dreamer. He said to them, Joseph says to his brothers, listen to this dream I had. Sorry, I've skipped a spot. Sorry. New journeys. Sorry. The power of dreams, I should say. A new journeys often start with a dream. But beware, God is a way of using dreams to reveal things about ourselves as much as about him. Maybe the power of dreams is revelation. So Joseph, a young man of 17, he's tending flocks with his brothers and he brings a bad report about them. The first thing we know is there's animosity between Joseph and his brothers. Are we surprised that there's animosity between them? Look at the history. This is God's covenant family. And look at the history so far. There's no love lost between Isaac and Ishmael. There still isn't. That family feud is played out on the screens of our nightly news. The same between Jacob and Esau. And here we have the son of the beloved, Rachel, hated intensely by the sons of who? The rejected wives. Jacob, he was all about Rachel. He wasn't really interested in Leah and Bilhah and Zilpah. He wasn't interested. They were slave girls. But it's deeper than this. This is a family that is characterized by an unsettledness. Israel is a spiritually and emotionally transient family long after they have settled geographically. And I look at this family and I think it's got a modern ring to it. They've settled, but they are spiritually and emotionally transient. And it comes really from the influence of Jacob, because Jacob is a mess. He's a mess. Who but Jacob? I mean, think about it, right? Who but Jacob was forced to play second fiddle to his brother Esau in his father Isaac's eyes? Who but Jacob should know better about the dangers of showing favoritism between kids? He was a victim of it himself. But that's exactly what he goes on to do. He's blind. Why is Jacob so blind to the damage that he's doing to the relationships between his kids by clearly favoring one over the others? It's because he's a man whose life is ruled by idolatry. He is the guy that said, if I just get the girl, then life will be great. That'll be it. That'll satisfy everything. I'll be happy then. He chased this false dream. And now we're in this situation where there's a big problem, isn't there? Because his dream is dead. Rachel dies. She's the first of his wives to die. And not only does she die, but she dies giving birth to... Anyone remember? Want to shout it out? Who does she die giving birth to? You say Benjamin, but no, that's not what she calls him. originally, she names him, as she's dying with her dying breath, she names him Ben-Oni. Do you know what that means? It means son of my sorrow. It's a tragic story. The trophy wife dies in sorrow. It can also mean son of my struggle. And it's so awkward. She names her son after a dying emotion, and Jacob just cannot allow it. And so it's Jacob that immediately disallows it and changes his name to Benjamin. And we know Jacob's not there yet in his own relationship with God because he is so still unsatisfied. And so he needs something to replace Rachel. He's lost Rachel. Who's going to be his next idol? Joseph. It couldn't be Ben because Ben reminds Jacob of Rachel's death. What's your fill in the blank? If I could just get this, everything will be great. We all have that thing that we're tempted to go, if I could just have that. Fill in the blank in your own mind. Jacob's idolatry supersedes his love for Joseph. It's so sad. And that whole animosity that's created by this dynamic, it's not helped by Joseph, who, let's just be honest, he's not exactly the most tactful guy, as we're going to find out. And the moment he has a dream, that's the last straw. We're going to read the story that I nearly jumped to earlier. The dreamer, he says to him, listen to this dream I had. I mean, what a great intro. Hey guys, check this out. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it. Yeah, okay. His brothers said to him, do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us? And they hated him. This is a strong language. All the more because of his dream and what he had said. And we'll flick over. And then he had another dream. It's like, and you, in this point, I'm like, Joseph, shut up. No. But he just keeps going. And he told it to his brothers. Hey, listen, I had another dream. And they're thinking, okay, yeah, what's this going to be? And this time, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars bowed down to me. Yeah. When he told his father and his, as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you? His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. What's going on there? There's something that tempers Jacob's response. There's something deep inside that restrains him. You know what it is? Jacob had a dream once. Do you remember that? We read about it in Genesis chapter 28. Jacob knows how important dreams can be. He had a dream once, and in verse 16, Genesis 28 verse 16, he rises from his dream and he says, surely the Lord was in this place. Surely the Lord was involved and I wasn't aware of it. Maybe God's actually involved and I'm just not aware of it. But what happened to Jacob? He's gone back to his idolatry again. The daily grind of life, the constant competition that characterized his family, he let his dreams go. See, for Abraham and Isaac, Canaan was a land of sojourning, but there's an important change in the language in the text that appears in Genesis 37. Jacob, however, settled in the land of Canaan. What does that mean? It means, you know what? I'm done with journeying. I'm done with all of this. I just want peace and quiet. I just want to settle. Victor P. Hamilton, the Old Testament scholar I like, he says it this way. He says, if Jacob expects an eventless retirement, he's going to get a rude shock. But I want to interrupt our story to ask you a personal question because I think Jacob's a very modern sort of character. In the humdrum of life, is there a dream that you've been tempted to give up on? And just go, you know what? I'm just happy. I'll settle for this. Have you grown impatient seeing a dream fulfilled? Have you even let go of a dream? If that's you, this one's for you. It's not too late. Enter Joseph. You see, there's another change that happens here in the book of Genesis that we don't get prior to this. There's dreams all over the Bible, but previously, even in his dream, Jacob and those before him, they heard God speak. There's an audible voice. God speaks, sometimes even appears one-on-one with people in Genesis. But with Joseph, do you notice, God never, ever actually speaks. All Joseph has is a vision. And friends, I want to tell you that here we've got a character who lived his life worshiping and trusting a God who was predominantly silent. And I say that to your encouragement, because sometimes we hear amazing testimonies, just like last week, and we'll do that again at some point. But sometimes some of us can feel a little bit left out. Have you ever been in that position, hearing someone giving a testimony and going, I wish that was me? God just, I don't know. Everything, he feels silent right now. Joseph is your Bible character. If that's you this morning, I want to tell you that Joseph's story is for the people who just keep plowing on, trusting the principles they learned when they were young, paying attention to their conscience, and seeking the kingdom even when they cannot necessarily feel it. And I want to encourage you with this. God saves the ancient world from starvation through someone who learns to trust him in the silence. When you're waiting, you're not doing nothing. You're doing the most important something there is. You're waiting for your soul to grow up. If you can't wait, you can't become what God created you to be. Okay, great, fine. But where does all this trusting God get Joseph? Well, Judah's betrayal. Yeah, that's deliberate. Betrayed for a few pieces of silver. Where have you heard that before? The problem is that Jacob's pathetic fathering produces a dangerous situation. Jacob, like anyone who is struggling with idolatry, runs from conflict. He doesn't want to handle it. He just wants his life to be fine and comfortable. He just is like, I'm retired. He cannot deal with it because he's settled. And so he idolizes more than loves. And you know this because he places his own emotional needs above his duties as a father. Hopefully you had a read of Genesis 37 during the week. But he sends Joseph, if you do the maths, 110 kilometers away from his personal sight and care, to check on a band of brothers who he knows cannot wait to get their hands on him. How do you make such a stupid decision as a father, as Jacob does? Because he's blinded by his own emotional needs. And so off goes Joseph alone on this massive long journey, away from the care of his father. And he meets this mysterious unnamed character in 37 verse 15. Wouldn't you love to know who that was? We're not told. Who sets the unknowing Joseph on his path of suffering when he tells him to alter his course to Dothan. And his brothers see him coming and they scheme against him. Here comes that dreamer, they say. Let's get rid of him. But Reuben, he comes up with the idea of sticking him in a cistern or a well so he can come and grab him later secretly. ancient cisterns were like, they're kind of like septic tanks, but ours are sort of just shaped like a barrel, or they don't really have septic tanks anymore, but ancient cisterns are more like a bottle. There's a big expanse at the bottom and they're like that, like a bottleneck. So it's a tiny, tiny little hole at the top into a vast black expanse underneath. And as Joseph is being lowered into the blackness, for all intents and purposes, he is experiencing the same sort of terror as someone being buried alive. This is by his own brothers, by the way. And amongst the echoes of their brother screaming for mercy, what do the brothers do? They have lunch. Who are these people? Maniacs. They have the audacity to sit down and have a meal. How is God going to transform this family? How is he going to pull this off? These are the names, friends, that are written on the gates of the heavenly Jerusalem in Revelation. Well, Judah speaks, and now he's having second thoughts, but it's got nothing to do with his care about Joseph. You're going to see that Judah is all about feathering his own nest. And so as they're eating their meal, you know, noshing on some bread, in the background, he notices these slave traders coming. And Judah, the ancestor of Christ himself, sells his brother for a few pieces of silver. Now, if you think your journey's tough right now, put yourself in Joseph's shoes. There you are, in the blackness of this well, the cistern. And you look up, and all of a sudden, these faces appear in the light far above. And a rope falls before you and unfurls. And the flood of relief over you. Oh, they were just joking. And so you hold onto the rope, and as you're tugged up, with every tug of the rope, you're like, oh, thank goodness, thank goodness. And then your face ellipses the top lip of the cistern, and you see the crooked smile in Judah's face and the irons. Oh no, surely not. Surely not. They would not do this to me. I'm a slave. You ever been betrayed by someone? In that bewildering moment. What? What? These things are real. And the physical pain as he is shackled with irons and probably branded or pierced, as was the custom of the time, is nothing compared to the emotional pain he must have felt to be sold out by his brothers, to be cut off from the love of the Father. Maybe you're been at a point where you've lost things precious to you, and maybe you've been betrayed even by family. And in that moment, you've asked the question, is God interested? Does he care? Does he see this situation, what is happening to me right now? This story's for you. Or maybe you're just asking at the moment in your life, God, is this detour, is this really necessary for me to go through? I mean, is it really necessary? I think I've learned my lesson. Don't tell everyone about my dreams. They're real. They hit here. This is a real family, and they are a mess. These things also, though, foreshadow the coming of the incarnate God, Jesus Christ, who gets dirty, who gets involved in our suffering, who knows what it is like to be betrayed, to be knifed in the back. And lastly, this is Jacob's version of Isaac. Genesis 37:31, it says they, that's the brothers, of course, they got Joseph's robe we weren't able to go into this, but you know, the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, just see the musical. They got Joseph's robe, a symbol of his favouritism that they hate so much. You know, the best way to make things stop Technicolor and rainbow, just cover them in blood, all red. And they slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe into the blood. They baptised the robe into the blood. Funny that. And they took the ornate robe back to their father and said, "We found this. Examine it to see if it is your son." They can't even say his name. They don't say our brother. Examine it to see if it's your son. You know, later on in the Bible, in Luke 15, remember the phrase of the elder brother when the younger son comes home? When this son of yours comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him? And so the brothers cover their tracks. They slaughter a goat and pour its blood over his coat. What do they slaughter? A goat. What? Okay, fine, a goat. What's the point? Question. What did Jacob use to fool his father Isaac? He slaughtered a goat. Slaughtered a goat. The irony. God is beginning to do a bit of a number on Jacob. What is he doing? He's taking away from Jacob the very same thing that he once demanded from his grandfather, the son in whom he loves. Abraham was asked by God, "Abraham, would you give up your son?" And now Jacob truly believes that his only son that he loves, or he thinks he loves, has been taken away from him. Not just any son, the apple of his eye. I'm just going to invite the band to come back up. What's also going on in that story? God is revealing how far he is willing to go to finish the job of this family's transformation. And I'm not just talking about like this, the family of Israel, the people of God's transformation. It's going to take the sacrifice of the beloved son. But unlike Abraham and Isaac, Jacob, he can't follow through. Do you know when someone loses their idol or their idols because they just can't see past it? And Jacob, he more than just grieves for Joseph. At the end of verse 35, Israel, the very one who wrestled with God himself, ceases wrestling. He gives up. He gives up. He gives in to hopelessness. And we're left with this question. How's God going to do it? How is God going to revive old Israel? How is God going to bring back hope? You just have to come back next week and find out.